My name again is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, and the name of this session is Nicaragua's Economy, the Real Threat. And this is the third in a series of three dealing with Central America issues. And again, just for those of you who don't know, and maybe for people who might order this tape from the outside, this is an issue that's obviously very important to me. My wife and I lived and worked in Nicaragua for 2 years. We came back in June of last year, June of 86. And I have been back to Nicaragua in December of this year, and I just returned about 2.5 weeks ago from revisiting Nicaragua. So I feel like my information is pretty up to date. I thought I would start out with having us do just a real quick brainstorm. And I want you, regardless of your political perspective, I want you to become the Reagan administration just for a minute. And I want you to throw out in a brainstorm form, and you've got to convince a skeptical U.S. public, why is Nicaragua dangerous? Now, again, this is a role play.
From Harlingen, Texas.
Okay.
It can become communist.
Okay, it's a communist. Yeah, it's so close
communist.
To the U.S.
It is communist.
It'll take over.
Domino theory.
Okay, the domino is headed our way. What else?
The Russians will have a base there.
The Russians are going to have a military base there. What else?
We've got to have freedom for those people down there.
Okay, we're really fighting for the freedom of people of Nicaragua. We're upholding the real values that we hold as U.S. people.
But yeah? Nicaragua is the only Contador nation who would not sign their agreement.
Okay, that's not true, but we say that. So Nicaragua wouldn't sign the Contador peace treaty. So they don't want peace. We've tried peace, and that doesn't work.
Well, I don't think they don't want peace. The Contador treaty says you have no foreign troops on your soil.
Okay. So they won't abide by the provisions of the Contador Treaty.
Well, they're exporting terrorism.
Okay, they're exporting their revolution and their terrorism throughout Central America and El Salvador. Okay, we'll go ahead, one more. Okay, the genocide against the Indians. Okay, those are all questions, some of those questions we can come back to. But then I want to ask you, now going back to yourselves, and maybe there are some of the same that we just threw out, maybe it's different, but what do you think? Why do you think Nicaragua is seen by U.S. government leaders as such a threat? What are the real reasons that you think Nicaragua is a threat?
Their independence.
What else?
So
possible economic interests and ties. Others? Okay, there may be a threat that other countries will look at Nicaragua and say, maybe we could make some of those changes too.
It's a threat to our whole ideology that socialism is evil and bad because they're doing things that are good.
Okay, so it's a threat to our ideology that says all socialism is bad, so we can't deal with the fact that some of the things they're doing are good. Okay, that's fine. It's a good background. And we'll come back to some of those issues. And again, I'm going to try to keep this presentation relatively brief so that we have a good time for discussion, unlike yesterday, in which I couldn't guarantee that. Okay, just to tell you my view from the top is that there are two major reasons why the U.S. is very concerned about Nicaragua. One is that we're used to controlling Nicaragua, and now there is a government there that we don't control. I asked the second in command at the U.S. Embassy why we were trying to overthrow the Nicaraguan government, and he said basically because Nicaragua wants to be free. And he made a very interesting analogy. He said, just as Eastern Europe lives under the heavy thumb of the Soviet Union, so too Nicaragua lives with a big uncle looking over its shoulder. Nicaragua cannot ignore history, end quote. So that, I think that makes that fairly clear. The other is the fear that somehow what's happening in Nicaragua will be picked up, or something similar will be picked up elsewhere. It's the fear of a model. Now, I'm going to talk about a lot of problems in Nicaragua and a lot of problems in the Nicaraguan economy, but that still holds true, I believe, those two things. Okay, just some basic background to shape the scene here. Point number two. Actually, it's point number one still. Is that Nicaragua, like many other what we call underdeveloped countries, has somewhat of a common history and common problems. Many of today's underdeveloped countries were colonized by outside powers. During that time, they saw their economic resources basically stolen in the forms of gold and silver and other resources. They saw land get concentrated, taken from indigenous peoples and put in the hands of a few people. They saw land use shift from basic food production for subsistence to export production of coffee, tea, sugar, and other kinds of export commodities. So away from indigenous needs towards what an export market was. They saw the imposition of a lot of forced, imposed labor systems. So that went through a variety of stages, slave labor. Then throughout Latin America, there was a system whereby indigenous people or Indians were forced to work. It was supposed to be 1 week out of a month free for the large landowner, and oftentimes it became more than that without any compensation, all kinds of forced labor systems. And very importantly, an infrastructure development within many of these countries, including Nicaragua. Infrastructure, by that I mean communication systems, roads, ports, etc., that were simply designed to move that coffee and tea or sugar cane or whatever the commodity might be out of a country, not an infrastructure that was designed to distribute wealth within a society. So that's another part of the common legacy. So with that legacy comes a fairly common. I don't want to get into a pattern here of saying that every country in Latin America is the same, every country in Central America is the same. It's not. For example, Costa Rica was blessed with the fact that it didn't have gold. Why is that a blessing? Because the conquest stopped before Costa Rica, and Costa Rica has evolved in a somewhat different fashion. Although if you want to ask me questions about where Costa Rica is headed, it's pretty frightening right now, in my view, as a result of U.S. policy. Okay. But a fairly common set of problems. One of those problems is concentrated land ownership. A major cause of world hunger throughout the world is the problem that land is owned by the few. And you see it very well in Central America. In El Salvador, about 1% of the people own about 60% of the land, and it's the best land. In Guatemala, between 2 and 3% of the people own about 80% of the land, between 70 and 80% of the land. Now keep in mind, in Nicaragua's situation, which I'll come to, was quite similar. Keep in mind that these are still predominantly rural societies in which land is absolutely central to meeting your basic needs or even beyond trying to make a living. Okay.
Jim,
other, yes?
Do you think it's true that I heard that the comment that the poorer a country is, the fewer people own the agricultural production land?
There is a pretty high correlation between concentrated land ownership and poverty, for the reason that if land is concentrated in the hands of the few, that means the wealth from the land is being concentrated in the hands of the few. So you have a very small internal market. You don't bring those people into the economy. And as a result, poverty becomes more widespread. And I'll come back to that in a couple of different ways here. Concentrated power in the industrial sector. Now, many of these countries have a relatively small industrial sector that was the result of a push in the 1960s by the United States, a program called the Alliance for Progress, that helped modernize the economies. But it did so in a way that created a little bit of industrialization or manufacturing, but it actually increased the gap between the rich and the poor. So it's not just that land is concentrated, it's overall economic resources. Banking, financial resources, those things too. As a result of that, you have a lot of widespread hunger, poverty, inequality, very common to all of these societies. That gives rise, not surprisingly, to a whole lot of social turmoil. Okay, that's kind of in the internal realm. Internationally, or what poor people living in underdeveloped countries have to face is another set of problems. And underdeveloped countries. First of all, they have very little control over pricing. for the goods that they sell. In other words, the countries in Central America, whether it be Costa Rica or El Salvador or Nicaragua or Honduras, have almost no control over the prices they receive for coffee, sugar cane, etc. They're dependent upon the export of a small range of commodities, and those prices are almost always going down relative to the things that they need to survive, the things that they import. Let me give you one example. In 1970, Nicaragua could export 100 bags of coffee, and it would get back 100 barrels of oil. Same value, 100 for 100. 1982, 12 years later, Nicaragua exported 100 bags of coffee. It got 3 barrels of oil. It lost 97% of the value of its principal export relative to oil. Now, we could give similar statistics with other commodities. Maybe not that graphic, but generally the same trend. Another international problem, and the reason I'm doing this is I want, as I go into the Nicaraguan economy, I want you to be clear that there are some things that a progressive government can attack, and there are some things basically totally outside of their control because they're part of an international system. So another one is a massive debt. Latin American countries today, just Latin America, now owe about $400 billion. The world's poorest countries as a whole owe more than $1 trillion. And last year, Western Europe and the United States and Japan, I believe, took out of the most underdeveloped countries through interest on their debt, their overall impact of trade, investment, aid, all those things, was that we took out $25 billion from the world's poorest countries. Okay, we can come back to that if you want to talk more about that. And the other international problem that they all face is that they're very dependent. For example, the Central American countries, I touched on this yesterday, are very dependent primarily on the United States. They have very little political leverage because of their economic dependency. And they're very vulnerable to decisions that are made in the United States. Okay. The long and the short of this is, for me, for the world's poor, there's very little hope. There's very little hope without major shifts, major transformation, fundamental transformation of their internal situations. In other words, internal revolution, internal fundamental social change is absolutely critical if we care about the world's poor majority. And secondly, there's very little hope for the world's poor majority without a similar fundamental restructuring of the international order. In other words, both of those things, from my perspective, my background, by the way, is for the past 15 years has been dealing with the issue of the politics and economics of world hunger. So I speak out of that background. Okay, now background on Nicaragua very quickly fits into this. The U.S. has been interested in Nicaragua for a long time. I don't know how many of you know that Nicaragua had a U.S. president. In the 1850s, William Walker went down. He was trying to expand the number of slave states. The U.S. was very interested in using Nicaragua as a route for the gold rush in California, because as hard as it is for us to imagine, it was easier to go down that coast, get on a river, go on a river in Nicaragua, up the river, across Lake Nicaragua, and then over about 20 miles of land to get to the California side and then move your way up. A major economic move in Nicaragua was the coffee boom that began in the 1850s and on the, up through the last part of the 1800s. Now, coffee is very labor intensive. That means that a lot of campesinos, people of the land, were forced off the land in order to work on coffee plantations. Another economic interest that the United States had was the idea of building a canal. Nicaragua was selected as the original site for a canal. And as you know, that didn't work out, so the U.S. sliced off a piece of Colombia, named it Panama, and then we built a Panama Canal. There may be some interest in some U.S. policymakers about an alternative canal site still through Nicaragua, because the Panama Canal is no longer serving. That might be one of the economic things that lie behind the hostility. Okay, Nicaragua is really divided into two countries, and I'm not going to talk a lot about this. It was cut in half. One half was colonized by Britain, and the main economic resources there have been in fishing, mining, forestry, etc. It's English speaking. It's where the indigenous peoples live. And the government, Nicaraguan government, has had a lot of problems and made a lot of mistakes in dealing with these indigenous peoples. Takes up half the country, and only about 9% of Nicaragua's people live there. It rains about 10 months out of the year. Very, very difficult to make a living there. The other side, which is where the main economic activity is, the Pacific Coast, that's Spanish-speaking, and the main enterprise, economic enterprises there have to do with agriculture, and specifically cotton, cattle raising, and other agricultural enterprises. Again, in Nicaragua, like many other countries, every time there was a major international boom in some commodity, whether it be coffee or cotton or sugar or bananas, every time that that happened, it resulted in a major displacement of people from the land and further concentrated land ownership. In other words, more land got in the hands of the few, which again accelerates the social turmoil. Okay, in Nicaragua, just to summarize, Nicaragua, before the ouster of Somoza, which is celebrated tomorrow, the 8th anniversary is tomorrow of Nicaraguan independence from Somoza and the United States. Somoza himself owned between 18 and 20% of the land. And when Somoza and his friends left, the government inherited about 25% of the agricultural land in the country. Okay. One other comment, and then I'll talk about the Somoza, the post-Somoza period. Again, in Nicaragua, as elsewhere, during the time of Somoza, during the time of the dictatorship, not only land resources were concentrated, but other economic resources. One symbol of that was, during the time of Somoza, only 16,000 farm families in Nicaragua, with a population of about 3 million people, only 16,000 farm families got credit from the bank for agriculture. Now, that pretty well tells a story, and it fits in with some of the changes that have taken place, that agriculture was for the elite. The banks were set up to service that elite. The whole society was set up in that way. One quick story. It's the best story I know that illustrates why you have a lot of social turmoil. It's a story told about the last Somoza. There were three Somozas that ruled Nicaragua basically from 1934 to 1979. The last Somoza visited neighboring Costa Rica, and he saw some healthcare projects and some daycare centers and some schools. And he was quoted as saying afterwards, "We don't want this in Nicaragua. We don't want people. We want oxen. We don't want people. We want oxen." The vast majority of people who are living in Central America today and many other underdeveloped countries live like oxen. What does that mean? It means they have no access to health care, no access to education, no access to services. They are simply work animals to bring in the crops for the rich. And also very important here, it's very important to understand that poverty in this instance is not only a consequence of exploitation. Poverty is a tool for continued exploitation. Because if you can keep people poor, and if you can get them to adopt an oxen mentality, then they won't make demands. Then they won't make changes. And that's what's so dangerous about liberation theology, because it affirms the dignity of the person, and those people are starting to make claims on the society based on that dignity. And that's why in that Santa Fe document that I mentioned yesterday, no, 2 days ago, that outlined some of the low-intensity conflict stuff, the United States says we must counter and work to overcome liberation theology. That's part of the Santa Fe report. Okay, very briefly, you get rid of a dictator, but you've got incredible problems. Some of those problems, war damage, many, many thousands of Nicaraguans killed. Somoza bombed the factories before he left. That was his final legacy to the people. A huge non-productive debt. Somoza had borrowed heavily, but basically for his own pockets, and left the country with a large debt and basically no production out of those loans that came in. the legacy of maldevelopment, of a focus on an infrastructure to get things out, or the ignoring of the training of human beings. So that there was almost no infrastructure in the form of schools, health clinics, that you need to have a healthy population in order to work. A shortage of technicians. Many of the few technicians that were in Nicaragua working closely with Somoza left the country. So you have a huge problem in terms of skill areas to be filled. It's a very young revolution. You have competing interests. Somoza leaves, and some of the rich who stay behind say, we're now the power brokers. We're the ones who know how to run this society. Good, we finally got rid of Somoza. He was getting too greedy. But don't talk to us about fundamental social change. Don't talk to us about land reform. Don't talk to us about inverting priorities. So you've got a lot of competing interests. You've got the Communist Party, which is one of the parties that has given the Sandinista Party the most trouble in Nicaragua, is the Communist Party. Almost no one knows that here. What do they want for their narrow group of workers involved in unions? They just wanted to triple wages because of past exploitation, which would have had a terrible impact in terms of the inflation rate and other things. And again, you have that legacy of dependency that doesn't change overnight, and you have an international pricing system that doesn't change overnight. Just because you have a revolution doesn't mean you're operating in a new world. You're operating or trying to in the old world. Okay, with that in mind, what are the changes that have taken place since 79? First of all, the principles of those changes. One principle is non-alignment. Another is political pluralism. Another is mixed economy. Another is popular participation. I'm just going to comment briefly on this and come back and talk about mixed economy. Non-alignment means that Nicaragua is saying, we don't want to be dependent on either superpower. We want to diversify our relationships and have relationships with as many countries in the world as possible. Have they been successful? Pretty much. They have greatly expanded their diplomatic and economic ties with countries all over the world. So you'll find a lot of help coming from the socialist bloc, a lot of help coming from Western Europe, a lot of help coming from Canada, a lot of help coming from the non-aligned country movement. So that's basically positive, except what I indicated a couple days ago, and that is that one of the products or outcomes of the U.S. policy of trying to have a war against Nicaragua and not live with Nicaragua is that it does force a certain greater dependency on the socialist bloc than Nicaragua wants. Okay. Political pluralism. Well, seven parties participated in the elections in Nicaragua, despite the fact that the U.S. tried to bribe the opposition parties out of the election so that the United States could say, see, there's no political pluralism in Nicaragua. No parties would participate. Well, seven, in fact, did, and they're a pretty broad range. Very few people, again, in the United States understand that the Sandinistas are pretty much of a middle ground party within Nicaragua. You have a Communist Party to the left of the Sandinistas. You have a Marxist-Leninist Party to the left of the Sandinistas. They each, by the way, got about 1% of the vote in Nicaragua's 1984 elections, which is pretty reflective of the kind of support they have within the country. Then there's also parties to the right, and the Conservative Democratic Party came in second in the elections. There was one group of people that was made up of a coalition of big business, La Prensa, the opposition newspaper that has since been shut down after the $100 million was approved last June, and a couple of small political parties and one political party whose presidential candidate was Arturo Cruz that didn't run. But overall, political pluralism in the context of a revolutionary society seems to be fairly well and alive in Nicaragua, although the war certainly puts a lot of pressure on that. Popular participation. You'll see a tremendous movement in the building of mass organizations in Nicaragua. So there's a lot more participation by the people in matters that affect their daily lives, from organizing for healthcare to campesino or people of the land organizations to small farmer organizations, all kinds of organizations that have a voice in what's going on. Okay, and then mixed economy that I'll come back to. Okay, the basic priorities since 1979, three major priorities: education, health care, and land reform. One of the first acts of the government was to carry out a literacy crusade with the help of and money of people all over the world. In that crusade, they basically closed the schools for 6 months, sent volunteers, mainly young people, out all over the country to the most remote parts of the country to live with the people, work with the people during the day, and then teach them how to read. Very, very successful campaign in at least two ways. One, they did reduce their fundamental illiteracy rate from over 50% to about 12%. So that's a major accomplishment, and they won all kinds of international awards for their campaign. But the most important impact may not have been that. It was the education that the educators got in the process. Because people had been totally cut off from the incredible poverty and deprivation of the vast majority of people in the countryside, suddenly came into contact and got to know and understand those people. Second priority, health care. Health care is now free and is a right in Nicaragua. They set up health posts. Very simple things. You'd laugh at them if you saw them. Little buildings, a few supplies, a doctor or nurse that comes a couple days a week, but a major improvement for many, many people, plus preventive health campaigns in the form of vaccinations that has eliminated polio in Nicaragua, an incredible accomplishment, reduced malaria, all kinds of different diseases. And if I have time later, I'll tell you a story about when I was getting rabies shots at the U.S. Embassy from a U.S. nurse, and that talks about the old healthcare system versus the new. So healthcare, a very important priority. Nicaragua has been selected by the World Health Organization as one of five model countries for their primary healthcare. Major achievements in health. And then land reform. I'll give some details on the land reform. Nicaragua is a relatively lucky country in that it has about 3 million people, is the largest country in Central America, and has the most land area in the smallest population, basically. So it has some land to work with. It also inherited land, as I mentioned, from Somoza. So the land reform has, in general, been carried out without a whole lot of confiscations from big landowners. In fact, the way that the Nicaraguan land reform reads is, you can own as much land as you want to in Nicaragua as long as you farm that land productively. In other words, as long as you're not decapitalizing your land. What does decapitalizing mean? If I own a coffee plantation, I don't take care of my coffee plants, it's clear I'm just going to get out one or two more harvests, that I'm letting them run down, which will ruin the plants, then my land could be confiscated. If I'm slaughtering all my cattle off so that there's no regeneration possibility, I'm clearly on my way out of the country, you can have your land confiscated. If you run your machinery over into Honduras and sell it, your land can be confiscated. The point I'm trying to make here, what the Nicaraguan government is interested in is productivity from that large land sector. It says we can live with a large land sector, but what we need is a productive large land sector. Okay, so that's part of the provision of the land reform. Another provision of the land reform is to try to give land to whoever wants to farm it. In other words, there's been a major transformation in the last, well, really the land reform started 2 years into the revolution, so let's say the last 6 years, about 100,000 Nicaraguan farm families have received land in the land reform. Now, that's out of maybe a possibility of 120 or 130,000 farm families. So it's a major, major difference. And I'll talk about that land reform in a little more detail, but basically to let you know that in the land reform in Nicaragua, the people are given a title to that land. They cannot resell the land, but they can pass it on through their families because they want to avoid just having it sold back or people getting forced off the land through one means or another, and then you end up in the same situation. But you get title to the land, it's free, you don't pay for the land, you don't inherit a debt, which is not true in El Salvador, for example. It's a pretty creative land reform program. And one other thing that I maybe will come back to is there's been quite a bit of shifts in the land reform. When the government first took power, it had a preconceived notion that it wanted to promote either collective agriculture or cooperative agriculture. And now, because the campesinos have been, they basically want their private plots, a shift has taken place, and that a lot of the land is now being given to, in private plots, but credit and service cooperatives still exist to try to manage that for the society as a whole.
Question.
Yeah.
Just a quick one. Is the implication then that right now that a lot of this 100,000 is in group situations as opposed to private plots? You said 100,000 out of the 120,000 families
in the last 5 years or so.
The last 5 years have received land. Is your last comment mean then that,
okay,
that was given in communal plots as opposed to private plots?
In the first year or so, most of the land was given in communal. Maybe the first year and a half. And the shift has been a gradual one, but it's been accelerating. So some of the trends you see is that a lot of the land that's being given in the land reform is the land that was inherited and became a part of the state sector. So the government in Nicaragua is divesting itself of land and using that land as the base for. Plus, land that was given in the forms of either collectives or cooperatives, the power has been turned over to those cooperatives to decide how they want to do it. And if they want to divide up that land into private plots and continue to order their get their credit together, they can do that. If they want to farm it collectively, they can do that. Some of those are working very well, and the people are very satisfied. But in other words, the freedom has been given to the campesinos to decide their land forms. And I would say it's accurate to say that the majority of them now are asking for private titles, and that that's what's happening in the land reform. Okay, again, trying to move. I'm not moving as quickly as I want to. Now, you can't carry out these programs without other institutional changes. And three of the most important, the sectors of the economy that the Nicaraguan government does control are these three. They control natural resources. They nationalize their natural resources. Now, in point of fact, that didn't mean a whole lot because the U.S. companies took out most of the good forests. Most of the minerals were taken out from 1900 to 1950 and 1960. But at least it gives them nominal control over their own resources that still exist and that may still be found. Second, they nationalize the banks. And that is absolutely critical to these other things. Because now in Nicaragua, not 16,000 as during the time of Somoza, 16,000 families are getting credit from the bank for agriculture. More than 120,000 farm families are getting credit from the bank for agriculture. So the government is able, by controlling the banks, to gear credit to the overall society, targeting the poor for priority, which is very offensive to some groups, as you might imagine. That does not mean that credit is not being given to the rich. The Nicaraguan government has been very, very generous with credit to the rich as well, in terms of those that are willing to produce. And the third, and maybe the most important institutional change, nationalized the export-import trade. Now, that may not sound very dramatic, and you probably don't know what export-import trade was. I didn't. But what it is, like just to give you an example, this is the most important change, probably, in trying to redistribute wealth to the people, is in an export society that earns its dollars through the export of coffee, sugarcane, bananas, and a few other commodities. The way the system was set up before is if I'm a large coffee producer, I sell my crop on the international market, probably directly to a U.S. company. That company pays me in dollars. And I use those dollars to buy Mercedes-Benzes, to fly to Miami, to buy my second house in the United States or Canada, all kinds of things. I use it for consumption as well as the running of my farm. The government nationalizes export-import trade, the situation changes dramatically. What happens now? I'm a coffee producer. The government guarantees me credit, guarantees me a profit, but it tells me I have to sell my crop to the government. So I sell my crop to the government, the government turns around and sells it on the international market, and the government gets the dollars. And what does the Nicaraguan government do? It turns around and pays me in Cordobas, which is the national currency of Nicaragua. You can't buy a Mercedes-Benz with Cordobas. You can't fly to Miami with Cordobas. And to tell you the truth, you can't do a whole lot with Cordobas in the midst of the economic crisis there, but you can still live well. I mean, you'll see me in the fancy restaurants. I'll be living a very good life, but it's not the life it used to be. I'm now much more of a Nicaraguan than I am an international citizen of the world that can consume anything that I want. Okay. That gives this gives you a little idea of what Nicaragua means by mixed economy. Basically, what Nicaragua wants to do through its economy is it doesn't want state ownership. If you heard Tom's presentation on his visit to the Soviet Union, he mentioned that all churches are even owned in the state union, in the Soviet Union. All private property is owned. All property is owned by the state. It's not true in Nicaragua. And in the area of production, more than 60% of the production of Nicaragua is in the private sector hands. The goal of the state in Nicaragua, in their idea of socialism, is to try to manage the economy to make private owners of production better stewards, basically to force them to be better stewards. Now, how do they do that? Well, one is, again, they can channel credit. So you're channeling credit to a broad range of the society rather than the few. Another is, while you try to maintain a pretty independent in terms of management private sector, and you want to promote economic growth, so you're trying to provide them with certain incentives, you're also trying to systematically redistribute wealth. And again, how do you do that? The export-import nationalization is the key there. And you can also do it through those laws of expropriation that I talked about. If people are not utilizing their land, they can be expropriated so that that land can then go to the productive sector. Now, how do the rich feel about this system? It's very interesting because the majority of the rich don't like it. You're not too surprised. They don't like it because the socialism of Nicaragua or the mixed economy of Nicaragua is not a road to unlimited profits and growth. Secondly, they don't have absolute rights to their private property. Owning something doesn't mean that you have the right to say that you're not going to use it to produce for the public good. You have to use those resources. So there's not an absolute right. Third, they've taken a lot of speculation out of things. They've taken kind of the fun out. You know, you could gamble this year on coffee prices and you can do this and that. You can't do that anymore. It takes the speculation out, which for some is to take the fun out. If you have a lot of resources and you're rich, you can afford to speculate. You can mess around a little bit, and if you lose 1 year, it doesn't matter that much. And also, they now need to respect unions, which they never had to do before. So they're mad, but they're mad most of all because they don't control political power. Nicaragua is one of the only countries in the world where wealth is not your vehicle to political power. Now, I want to say on the other side, so I don't give you a distorted view, there are a lot of rich Nicaraguans who are very much involved in supporting the Nicaraguan Revolution. And for me, that's one of the challenges for us. There are some of the examples of people who have given up a lot of their wealth because they believe that it's necessary to do that. They really do believe that liberation theology is not just a message to the poor, but it's a message to the rich to restructure societies in ways in which there will be greater equality. So there's a lot of rich people who are involved in this revolution. Not the majority, but there are many. Okay. The question then within Nicaragua is not so much whether most of the rich will be converted to the revolution. The question is, will a majority of the rich be willing to live within the framework of the revolution? Many of the rich have left. They're in Miami. They're supporting the counter-revolution, so there's a clear answer there. But there are many others that are still in Nicaragua, and according to the economist that I talked with just a couple weeks ago, he's very encouraged that many more of the rich in Nicaragua are accepting the existence of the revolution and are beginning to function within it. I should also point out that the government has made some interesting changes, some accommodations. Remember I said that they nationalized export-import trade, and then they, instead of paying the people in dollars, they paid them in Cordobas? Now they're paying them in Cordobas, but they're also giving them dollar incentives. So they get partial payment in dollars as an appeasement, and that's helping. It's very interesting, Sarah, you'll be interested to note that more and more large farmers are leaving COSEP which is the largest, most conservative business organization in Nicaragua, and joining UNAG, which represents the small and medium and other producers in Nicaragua, because COSEP refuses to participate in any way, and these people are making a decision, we may not like everything about this, but we're willing to produce and try to work. So there seems to be a shift taking place.
Just in support of that, Jack, we had a few people from Nicaragua that visited Granite Falls, and he farmed, the couple farmed about 1,400 acres, and he said we weren't, you know, we didn't have our land taken away from us.
Right.
You know, he was a member of the parliament, I think it was, the governing body of the country. He was not a member of the Sandinista Party, but he was
right.
very supportive of the reforms that had taken place.
One of the, this is an aside, but one of the very interesting things about the Sandinistas, which again is the largest party in Nicaragua, their understanding of political pluralism is when they moved into elections for 84, the Sandinistas were clearly a popular force in the country. So they structured their party to invite a whole lot of people to participate on their platform, to participate in their party in the elections who were not members of the party, including a lot of large landowners, because they wanted them to be represented in this overall mix of the assembly. So there's, of the 63 or 64, something like that, representatives that the Sandinistas won out of 96 in the National Assembly, 20 or 22 of those are not members of the party. But they were brought in, and the Sandinistas were also the ones that brought in a lot of women to maintain that balance, that really tried to structure their platform and their party membership in a way that would be a broad, reflect a broad base of the people. Okay, let me, I'm almost, I promise, I'm almost done. I'll be done in 3 or 4 minutes here. It's timey, Sarah. Okay, success and problems. Nicaragua had the fastest growth rate in all of Latin America, 1980, 1981, the beginning of 1982. They had the highest investment rate of any country in Latin America. They had the greatest improvements in social indicators in terms of improvements in life expectancy, healthcare improvements, literacy improvements, etc. If you went to Nicaragua during those days, you felt that something was happening. You could just feel it in the air. Now, Noam Chomsky has an interesting theory. He says, the smaller the country, the more dangerous it is to the United States. Why? Because if a little tiny country like Nicaragua, a terribly poor country like Nicaragua, can start improving the lives of its people, that's going to give people all over the world ideas. So you don't have to look at Nicaragua and say, boy, Nicaragua's got all these resources that the U.S. wants. It's the fact that Nicaragua doesn't have a whole lot of resources and was improving the lives of the people that means that we have to destroy it. That hope is very dangerous from the perspective of the U.S. Another thing that makes Nicaragua dangerous is that it doesn't fit into the U.S. mold. It's a different kind of socialism, as Barry mentioned earlier. And another is what you brought up, the danger of the domino. Not the domino of exporting revolution with guns, but the domino of giving people ideas. A Honduran priest visited Nicaragua not long ago, and he was asked, well, what do you think, and why does Honduras expend so much energy trying to convince everyone in the country that the Sandinistas are evil? He said, well, if the campesinos in Honduras knew what was happening in Nicaragua, we'd have a revolution in Honduras. And I think that there's some truth to that. Okay, the U.S. response has obviously been primarily to use the Contra War as a method of economic destabilization. Again, if you're interested in this, listen to my presentation on low-intensity war that I gave a couple of days ago. The Contra War is essentially an economic war, a war to terrorize, a war to force Nicaraguan government to shift its priorities from revolution and development into warfare. And that's what we've done. Nicaragua's military budget was 7% of its budget in 1980. It's between 50 and 60% of its budget now. Nicaragua's economy, by the way, has totally collapsed, along with most of the economies in Central America. Life in Nicaragua is much worse today for your average Nicaraguan, probably other than some of the campesino sectors. If you go to Managua, much worse today than it was 7 years ago, 8 years ago. The war has taken an incredible toll. Now, also, the government made mistakes. The Nicaraguan government, and I'll just mention some of these. It subsidized consumer prices to the point that it fed inflation. It was requiring campesinos to sell their crop to the government at government-controlled prices in ways that discouraged production. Now, the changes that have taken place, the subsidies have basically been lifted from the consumer goods, and the prices to farmers have gone way up, and basically the government must now compete with private buyers to buy the crops of the campesinos, and that's having an impact on production. In other words, they've opened up the economy in terms of giving campesinos freedom to produce at a market price. And then I already mentioned the changes in the agrarian reform. The thing that impresses me about the Nicaraguan government is not that it doesn't make mistakes. We can expect, particularly in the situation I outlined, that there's going to be a lot of mistakes. What impresses me is the flexibility with which they respond to mistakes. And if it weren't for the war, I think we would have seen a lot of improvements in Nicaragua because of that flexible response. The future for Nicaragua is very bleak unless this war ends. And basically what you have in Nicaragua today is a survival economy. People are surviving, and that's it. And the question is how long they can survive, because obviously the purpose of the war from the U.S. is to try to get the people to withdraw their support from the revolution. It reminds me very much of the passage in Egypt, when the people leave Egypt and they're in the wilderness, and they start murmuring and saying, let's go back to Egypt. Not many people in Nicaragua want to go back to Egypt, go back to the United States. But many of them, you'll hear a lot more complaining in Nicaragua related to the economic situation, very justly so. The hopeful thing for me is that not much of that economic complaining translates into contra support. There seems to be very little contra support within Nicaragua, in my opinion. Okay, I'll stop there now. We've got some time for questions. Yes?
What's the reason for Reagan continuing the war? I don't understand it.
Well, the war serves a very, very important function.
What I'm saying is, does this country side with the rich of Nicaragua and want it to be revert to where it was?
You've got it. Exactly. But the U.S., you need to remember, the U.S. backed the Somoza dictatorship from 1934 to 1979, as it was clear that Somoza was finally going to be ousted, or that likelihood was there. You had shifts within Nicaragua in terms of some of the rich that had been aligned with Somoza withdrew their support from Somoza. And the U.S.'s role from the very beginning, when it was clear that Somoza was leaving, was to try to ensure that the rich sectors, particularly COSEP, the one I mentioned earlier, that they would be the new power brokers in Nicaragua. So in other words, finally the U.S. accepted, we need a change. Okay, we'll accept a change. We'll accept the ouster of Somoza, but we want to put a pro-U.S. government that we can control that will basically reflect the interests of the upper classes in Nicaragua in power. And that's the goal. I mean, that's the goal. The ultimate goal of U.S. war is that we want to do that. We want to put a new government in power that will protect the interests of the rich and not the vast majority of people. So the purpose of the war at this point, that's the goal, but that's a real distant goal. The real goal right now is just to undermine. It's what I called in my presentation 2 days ago, that defining victory as destruction.
Well, then what you're saying is, do we have such heavy business interests? Do our manufacturers have such heavy business interests that they control our government?
Let me make one comment, and then we'll get another question from someone else. And that is that in the Kissinger Commission report, which was President Reagan's bipartisan commission on Central America, they said any threat to a U.S. interest anywhere in the world, no matter how small, in other words, no matter how little there might be direct economic investment in Nicaragua, it's a threat to the entire global system. Now, so if you're asking me, are there business interests in Nicaragua that would warrant what we're doing? Probably not. If you ask me in all of Central America, well then maybe, because Guatemala, there's many of the Fortune 500 corporations are operative in Guatemala. If you take the region as a whole, or if you look at it from the framework that I am, that the U.S. is worried that, okay, Nicaragua starts improving its living standards, the people of the Philippines hear about that, they're going to want to do that, the people, and believe me, You go almost all over the underdeveloped world, they've heard of Nicaragua. They know about what's going on in Nicaragua, and they're talking about what's going on in Nicaragua. So it's an example that could be very dangerous to very big economic interests in places like the Philippines and elsewhere.
Well,
yes?
It seems like a lot of the reason that people give that their administration is for support being so hard on Nicaragua is that, you know, the domino theory is going to move up through Mexico and so forth. Can you comment briefly on whether the Mexican situation is at all in the same form as in the Latin American things, and whether you see Mexico eventually going down this road is there an elite which in a lot of the people are subjugated, or what? How does that? Because that's gonna
right
to me. That's the key thing in terms of what people try and justify their actions.
Yeah, okay, just a comment on the domino theory, and particularly related to Mexico. What's interesting about that, about the U.S. saying that what we're really doing, a lot of U.S. policymakers will say, our real fear is Mexico, the oil fields of Mexico, and we've got to stop them in Central America, they're going to take over Mexico. What's interesting about that is the Mexican government is one of the strongest supporters of the Nicaraguan government, providing oil, providing credits, providing all kinds of things, in the midst of its own terrible economic crisis. Now, it's very complicated, but basically what you have in Mexico is you have a one-party state that still lives with kind of the facade of being a revolutionary government, in which the foreign policy of that government is controlled by the most progressive forces in the society, and the internal economic domestic forces are controlled by the most conservative. So you have a government that's progressive in terms of its foreign policy and quite repressive of its own people domestically. Not as much repression of torture and those kinds of things, so that does exist to a certain extent. But in terms of the economic policies that's following in Mexico, the poor are being crushed. Basically, they're carrying out the IMF, the International Monetary Program, of you cut all the subsidies to the poor. So they're bearing an enormous burden. Now, is that going to result in revolution in Mexico? Maybe 200 years from now, that's an exaggeration, but the psychological oppression that has been fed by all kinds of forces in Mexico, particularly the church, but others as well, makes some kind of uprising in Mexico, a major one, seem fairly distant to me. At least on a progressive line, it's going to be very distant. So I think the United States uses that argument, uses the domino theory argument as a justification for what it's doing, but I don't think that it's very real. However, the domino theory is real in the sense that if Nicaragua were to be able to carry out its positive example and improve its living standards, and other people know about it, and they do know about it in El Salvador, and some sectors do know about it in other places, that does feed the aspirations of people. Is that an okay answer or clear enough? Okay, Larry.
What's your interpretation of the heavy use in the conservative press and pointing to the Soviet support, the Cuban support, and that kind of stuff? I mean, how do you interpret that?
What are the roles of the Soviets and the Cubans and the press playing on that? The Soviets and the Cubans are active in Nicaragua, and they're very important to Nicaragua. The Cubans provide about, I don't know what the figure is now, but I would guess around 600 military advisors to the Nicaraguan government, for example. There are Cuban teachers in Nicaragua. Cuba has helped them with some development projects. They were active along with a lot of other people in the literacy crusade and things. The Soviet Union's role has been primarily that of the defensive weapons supplier. Nicaragua has basically no offensive weapons. It has some fighting helicopters that it uses against the Contras that they've gotten from the Soviets. And again, there's a history to that the Soviets were the last choice for the Nicaraguans. They went first to the U.S., then to Western Europe, and then as a last resort, because the U.S. basically cut off the other possibilities. So the Soviets are there, and the Soviets have been important in providing some economic aid, enough economic aid to help Nicaragua survive, and that's it. They've provided oil. And it's interesting, if you've been reading, the Soviet Union is now cutting down. It is going to supply Nicaragua with, I think, about 40% of its oil instead of almost 100%. Why did the Soviet Union do that? I think it did it because, and this is what the economists in Nicaragua told me and other people, that the Soviet Union was very concerned that the United States would use Soviet supplying 100% of its oil or greater economic dependency as a pretext to destroy Nicaragua. And so the Soviet Union has been lobbying in Latin America saying Latin America as a whole has a stake in Nicaragua's independence and you've got to help economically. Well, what's happened? Venezuela and Mexico, both in financial trouble, are now supplying Nicaragua with oil again. It's very interesting. So the Soviets are actually playing an opposite role that we accused them of, which I find pretty fascinating. Now, I want to just add that while those areas of support are important, the most critical areas of support for Nicaragua have been Western Europe and Canada has supplied a lot of economic assistance and continue to, many of the Western European countries. You'll find a lot of technicians, a lot of projects that are going on, and also the other non-aligned countries. But the problem that Nicaragua is in right now is that no one's helping them to the extent that really helps, other than ensuring their bare survival. So all those things the Soviets have a role in Nicaragua, but the Nicaraguans are absolutely determined not to sell themselves out to another superpower. It would be a tragedy for them, and they understand that. So I think the role that the Soviets and Cubans are playing in Nicaragua is a very positive role. And it's much more positive to the degree that Nicaragua was able to maintain that diversity of relationships. And again, ironically, the Soviets are encouraging them to even further diversify, which is pretty interesting. Sarah?
Just on the whole Soviet-Cuban thing, I think it's important to note that Nicaraguans are willing to send all those people away, that whole business with Contadora that someone mentioned, that part of the agreement would be that the Central American countries would have to rid themselves of foreign military advisors. And Nicaragua said, fine, we'll do that. And especially in, what year was it? Was it May of 85 or something?
September of 84 is when the first draft was signed.
No, but I mean,
when they sent home.
They sent home 100 military advisors.
Yeah, May of 85.
They sent 100 Cuban military advisors home and said, this is our first step and we're willing to do more, but we'd like to see what the United States is going to do with the Contra and the military advisors in other Central American countries. And we didn't change our policies at all. So I think it's really important to know that Nicaragua is open to.
And the Nicaraguans have been committed from the very beginning. They've said we do not want a Soviet military base, and there won't be one in Nicaragua. So the Contador, it's very important to stress the Contador thing as Sarah does, which really resolves most of the legitimate security interests that the United States might have. You know, okay, Central American countries will send home all their foreign advisors. There won't be foreign military bases. There won't be importation of offensive weapons. All that is covered by Contador. But two quick comments about Contador. Why won't the U.S. let Contador go through? Two reasons. One, if the U.S. accepts Contador, it has to accept the existence of the Sandinistas as being the ruling power, the largest elected government in Nicaragua. And it won't do that, so therefore we seek military solutions. But here's the kicker in the background, my opinion only. What issue will the Contador countries take up next if they succeed in Central America in this peace initiative? The international debt. And that's the issue that terrifies the United States, because if just Brazil stops paying the debt, every major U.S. bank is bankrupt. If Mexico stops paying just its debt, every major U.S. bank is bankrupt. So I think that's what's lurking behind our fear of independence. It's not only what a little country like Nicaragua will do, but its influence in trying to get other countries to come together to resolve some of those international problems. Yeah.
One of the other areas of kind of bad press in this country that I ran across was kind of a black market, things that were made in Nicaragua that were a lot of the products were exported, but then apparently there's some sort of a quota system that requires a certain amount to be sold in the country. Did you see any evidence of that kind of a black market?
Well, during the time of Somoza, the economy was geared much more directly towards exports. And some of the changes in a couple of industries that have taken place, for example, in leather. One of the factories we used to visit, it was a very large leather factory. And the government did, in this instance, it's one of the only leather factories in the country, say that all of your leather production needs to be for domestic use. So there have been some examples of that in key industries, because the leather was used primarily in the production of shoes for people, where they said that we need an internal domestic thing in order to provide for our needs. So there have been some things like that. And the government, by nationalizing export and import, controls imports as well as exports. So it puts priorities on imports that are needed for the production of basic goods, etc.
How many Americans, such as Linder, are down there now at this time? Do you have any idea?
Boy, there's always estimates of, the latest ones I heard was a couple of thousand U.S. people who are working in Nicaragua.
That many?
Yeah. And that might include witness for peace. It would include hundreds of CIA agents. it would include a lot of development workers. So there are many, many, many. And one of the exciting things about Nicaragua is this incredible array of international people who are there working, usually in solidarity. Obviously, the CIA has a different role. So it's quite extensive. I just want to make one more comment, then I'll get another question. I want to be real clear here in what I say, because I sometimes get accused of being one-sided, is that the Nicaraguan government is not a perfect government, and it has made mistakes, both in the economic realm, it's made mistakes in dealing with the indigenous peoples, etc. But what I want to be very clear is that the United States is not trying to overthrow the Nicaraguan government because of its mistakes. I mean, if we were going to do that, we'd have to overthrow ourselves, we'd overthrow the El Salvadoran government, we'd overthrow a whole lot of other people before we'd pick on Nicaragua. What makes it so important for the U.S. to destabilize Nicaragua is the successes and basically the philosophy that says that the interests of the poor are going to come first. That's what has to be overthrown. Anybody who hasn't asked a question? Yeah, first.
There's a dentist from our community that annually goes down with another group of health care workers to Honduras. And he is of the opinion from the primarily the Indians that he provides service to, apparently, that the U.S. policy in Nicaragua is correct. Why would you have any inkling of an idea of why he would come back with that feeling?
Certainly. If he is going down on the Honduran border and working in areas where the Mosquito Indians are, it would be very understandable. And I'll try to cover a very complicated issue in a minute response. But basically, I mentioned that the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua is where the indigenous peoples live. Historically, there's always been hostility between the Spanish-speaking side and the other side. When Somoza was ousted, the Sandinistas sent over people, and basically they announced, "We won, we won." And the people went, "What did we win? What do you mean?" They had very little relationship with Somoza other than the fact that factories came in and or companies came in and took out resources, etc. So basically what happened was, make a long story short, the United States was involved with some groups of the Mosquito people. And there was a plot that was going to invade Nicaragua, take over a small piece of territory, declare that an independent Nicaragua. This was early on, Christmas of 81. It was called the Red Christmas Plot. And the Sandinistas also, by the way, made a lot of mistakes going over, not understanding their culture. And there were individual cases, not government-sponsored, but individual cases of soldiers in which about 70 Mosquito people were killed by soldiers in various incidences in towns. Most of those 70 soldiers are now in jail, but the legacy lives on, right, creating the suspicion. Anyway, the worst thing was the government, Nicaraguan government, made a decision in light of this Red Christmas Plot of 81 to relocate the Mosquito people who were living along the Rio Coco River, which forms a boundary with Honduras, but for the Mosquito people, it's not really a boundary. The river is their life, and they go over on both sides of the border freely. Well, what the government did says you have to move. You can move to the Honduras side, you can move into Nicaragua, you can move to a relocation camp that we've set up, but you have to move. Well, everyone says the move was done in a fairly gentle and good way, but still you force them to move. And then what do? They burn the 75 villages so that they couldn't be used by Contra forces coming and invading Nicaragua. Well, as a good friend of ours who's a priest that worked for 25 years on the Atlantic coast says, it's going to take 10 years just to heal that. So there have been, as I say, real mistakes made by the government in terms of the Mosquito people. If he is doing his work in those camps, it's very understandable why you're going to have that hostility. One little addition, though, there's some incredibly positive things going on. I talked about the pragmatism of the government, and one of them is one of the government leaders from Nicaragua was just over at a huge conference of Mosquito people, and he said, the only thing we can possibly do at this point is to ask for your forgiveness.